I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Dow Jones could hit the 20,000-point mark any day now, and all three major stock indices have reached record levels lately. But what goes up must come down. For some stockholders, how long this upswing lasts will mean everything. So we've got the smart money experts back to tell us if it's time for investors to adjust portfolios or to cash in on stocks and bonds. Then it's just a 0.25%, but what should we make of only the second interest rate bump since the Great Recession? We'll also get their thoughts on the Trump rally markets are experiencing these days and a newfound surge in oil prices. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There's a lot of talk these days about the Dow Jones Industrial Average reaching 20,000. Back when I was in 10th grade, the Dow cracked 1,000, and that was seen as a big deal. So the question on the table today, how should investors adjust their portfolios given historical highs in stocks and bonds? Or should they do anything? We're going to kick that around this morning with our team of smart money experts, and they are Lucas Butchel, who's a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, happy holidays to you.
Yeah, same to you. Good morning.
Alex Petrovic is back. He was around also when the Dow last hit 1,000. He's founder of Petrovic Financial Services. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
David Jackson is with the Financial Planning Association. David, good morning.
Great to be here, Steve.
Well, what about the, let's go to some current news developments and the Fed last week adjusting short-term interest rates 0.25% just a few days ago. David, how significant of a moment is this?
Well, the significance is the fact that it actually happened. We've been talking about it supposed to happen for a while.
Coming, yeah. And it finally came.
Yeah, they kept coming up with reasons not to do it and to delay it. And so now it's happened. A 0.25% doesn't mean a whole lot in and of itself, but it's the trend that it's setting. So we kind of know that going forward, interest rates will be rising. That's going to have an effect on CD rates, savings rates, but it's also going to have an impact on your mortgage rates and, you know, other interest rates. So there's a good and a bad to it.
So 0.25%, Lucas, when it comes to saving money, what does that do for folks who have money tied up and hope to see some interest coming in?
It really doesn't mean much at all. So there's a study done that it takes banks about 8 months to pass along an interest rate move by the Fed in terms of higher CDs and savings rates.
I saw that in your notes. Why is that? 8 months? Doesn't sound right to me.
I mean, there's nothing requiring them to pass that along, and it's a competitive market, right? And banks have really been pinched for so long by these super low rates that financial services companies are probably going to try to pocket a little bit of that in terms of money. And if nobody else is doing it in the marketplace and getting competitive, there's no real competitive incentive for a bank to do so.
Well, come on. I shouldn't be weeping for the banks this holiday season. I think they're doing just fine, generally speaking, aren't they, with all the fees I see tacked on here and there every month?
You know, generally speaking, yes. I would say compared to historical numbers, the financial services is actually an area that's been hurting comparatively over the last business cycle. But, you know, that appears to be changing now as we've seen some direction, and what David's saying, it was what appears to be more of a trend now towards some rising interest rates.
Alex, we're sitting here talking about 0.25%, the increase in the short-term interest rate here, but home mortgages have been going up more than that, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I think it's just the by and large. It's a shorter time frame for a lot of people to look at, but some of this is leveraged and it's been so low. And the trend actually started before the election. We've seen this trend up, but it's been all over the board. Interest rates are really not too far off from where they were in January this year. Mm-hmm. Mortgage rates are quite different.
Because that's a longer term deal, right, than a short term interest rate that the Fed's dealing with here.
Yes. Well, both the short and the long end has increased, but maybe
the long's going faster.
Articulate that better.
Right. And really, since the election, what you've seen is the longer-term interest rates have moved up higher. So the 10-year Treasury is a good bellwether. It's an intermediate-term interest rate, but it runs a lot closer to what mortgage rates do than the short-term rates we're talking about with the Fed. And you've seen the 10-year go from around 1.7% before the election, now running up close to 2.6%. That's a big move.
That's a big move. That's almost a full point.
Yeah, exactly. And especially coming off of a 1.7, which is a really low number. And so, you know, what's driving that? I really think ultimately it's investors in bonds are now starting to see what looks like signs of inflation, especially as we look out with some potential government stimulus, fiscal stimulus, if you will, in terms of infrastructure spending and tax cuts. And so what those long-term investors are saying is if inflation is going to increase, we need to be getting compensated more on these fixed, longer-term fixed investments. And so I think higher inflation expectations is really what's driving that. And mortgage rates tend to move up in the same way.
So what that kind of really means to the average consumer out there, I had a conversation with a client last week who has an adjustable rate mortgage. And so we can see rates are going to go up on mortgages. I advised him, well, now would be a great time for you to lock in your mortgage rate, go to a fixed rate, because we know your adjustable rate is going to continue to rise. Mm-hmm. Why not lock in? And so to put it in context, I used to sell real estate back in the mid-'80s. And I was selling real estate when mortgage rates were at 15, 18%.
I bet that was fun.
Yeah. I mean, but people were still buying homes because you didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, if rates are going up, but you can still get a mortgage rate of 4 or 4.5%, that's still historically a great deal.
You get a sense that this country's fiscal policy is still very much reflective and a reaction to just those times you're talking about. No one ever wants to see 15, 20% interest rates again in this country, and we've done all kinds of things to avoid just that, haven't we?
Right, but there are still some older folks out there who look back to the days when they could earn 15, 18% on their CDs and thought that was a great deal. I mean, right. They really thought that was good. Our money market that was paying close to 20%. But yeah, when you have runaway inflation, those rates really are kind of meaningless.
Is it possible we could see those kinds of rates again, or are things, Fed policy, more sophisticated these days, and they could stave off something like a runaway inflation rate in this country?
You know, that's a great question. I will always say never.
Well, of course.
It's always, yeah. It's always possible. But I do think the Fed has continued to learn and kind of build a body of knowledge and hopefully is better equipped to deal with inflationary pressures like that. The other thing that they've done that they hadn't done before was they've really been willing to kind of get into this non-conventional stuff, such as, you know, buying and selling bonds on the open market. The Fed in the 80s and in the 70s before that, that really didn't seem to be in the playbook. And so the Fed has expanded their tools.
It's a more activist Fed today, perhaps, you're saying.
Absolutely. And really, over since the financial crisis, unprecedented levels of new tools and being willing to participate in areas that they weren't before. You know, I think that's generally a positive thing if you're dealt a situation where you know, you've got runaway inflation and the traditional measures aren't handling it. They've already shown a willingness to go beyond that and try some other things.
Okay, you just heard it here on Up to Date. Lucas Butchell saying we will never, ever again have 15% interest rates again. Alex, you buying that logic from your partner here?
Well, never say never, but I think globally as well, there's some constraints on inflation. The global markets, the GDPs are much slower. They're still unwinding the large amount of debt. So it doesn't appear that rates are going to get high that quickly. Aside from one option is, in this country in particular, is that we're nearly at full employment. Many mm-hmm. people think we are in full employment. And if we do have a significant fiscal spending, like roads and bridges, airports, ports, and so forth, it's going to come at the cost of higher wages. And people that are out there making an hourly living will embrace this. But the markets will react negatively, and that will push up rates.
You lost me there. So if we do a big stimulus package in terms of infrastructure spending in the Trump administration, you're saying what's the effect on wages
well,
then?
Because we're at full employment already. So in order to get skilled people to work on these projects, you're going to have to pay them more to take them from where they are already working.
Oh,
so their labor will be in more demand. They'll have more power. And wages are one of the largest contributing factors to inflation in this country.
That's interesting.
I mean, just think of any operation in our shop. We have 9 people, and certainly our wages are a lot more than our technology or our lease.
Yeah.
So wages quickly can affect this inflation, and that would bring the Fed in to raise rates higher. So then what we would rely on as a country is higher productivity, and we've hit some levels kind of peaking out in productivity at this point.
All right.
One of the interesting things, though, components that right now, usually the Fed, when they're raising rates, is to slow down the economy. The economy's starting to get away from us, and they're trying to slow things down. Right now, the Fed is raising rates just to get it back to normal. It's not because the economy is moving so fast that they need to slow it. It's just it's so low because they kept rates almost to zero to try to recover from the economic crisis, and now we're just getting back to normalcy.
What's your best guess, David, as to how high they're going to raise the short-term rates? I mean, are we going to 2% or 4%, or do you have any even a ballpark guess?
I would be afraid to even touch that. Lucas, do you have a comment on that? I'll throw it over to you.
That's called passing the buck,
by the way.
Yes,
it is. Yeah. I'm good at that. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think the Fed has a specific number in mind. I think what they're going to do is they're going to continue to watch those indicators of unemployment and inflation, and if they feel like the economy is starting to get hotter, they'll continue to start ticking that up to help stave that off. Inevitably, though, we're going to hit another recession. Business activity is going to slow down, and that'll naturally happen, and the Fed will then start cutting rates. So where they peak out, I think, really depends on what happens with our economy. If we have a really quick burst of growth, I think you could see them be more aggressive and hit a higher number. If the fiscal promise of next year doesn't come in as strong as maybe the market's projecting right now, I think you may have a little bit slower and a little lower number on the ultimate number we get to with the Fed.
We've had two of our smart money experts pass the buck here. Alex Petrovic is going to give us a firm number here and
give us a clear
sense where we're going.
Historically, you're talking about a Fed funds rate, which is a short rate in that 5 to 6 area. It gives them some powder to lower rates in a recession. What they're talking about now is maybe that 3% would be more normal.
Mm-hmm.
But what's been normal recently? So,
right. Okay.
Leave it at that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our smart money experts about some latest news developments in the world of America's economy. How about the Trump rally here? The Dow Jones is up 7%, S&P 500 up 6%, the Russell 2000, the small cap index, is up 15% since Election Day. What do you guys make of it, and why are the averages bouncing up like this? Because, you know, as a guy who covers politics, the early forecast was that the markets would drop if Donald Trump won. He won. Everything's going up, which means, of course, once again, none of us know anything about what's going on in the world out there. Why are they up?
It's all about speculation for more growth and more inflation. So the Trump policies that look like are going to be coming in next year, a big tax cut, which is going to be putting more money in the hands of Americans. You can argue about who's going to get that money and how it's going to be distributed, but I think on the whole, it's a big cut and direction of money into the hands of the private sector. And the second one is that infrastructure spending that we were talking about just a minute ago, which would put more people to work and inject a lot of spending out there into the economy, which should be good for corporations and profits, and that should drive stock prices higher. So what you've seen now is market participants are expecting that stimulus next year, and so they're kind of bidding up the prices of stocks as a result. So the real question, I think, is going to go when we flip from speculation to actual policy.
Mm-hmm.
And are we going to get the infrastructure spending that is being promised? Are we going to get the tax cuts that everybody thinks are going to happen next year? If those don't get delivered, I think you'll see a market sell-off.
And I think to your point, Steve, I think what was happening, was trending prior to the election, was the thought that if Trump got in, there'd be divided government and there'd be gridlock. But since it's all kind of one-sided now, then the plans can, you'll in divided government and things can go through. So things like infrastructure will actually happen because, you have the Senate and the House that are going to be voting on what Trump wants to do.
Well, the impact here, though, on America's budget deficit is extraordinary, though, for sitting here. And we've talked about this on our last show, this notion of an infrastructure package and a tax cut. We're talking a few billion dollars more to our national budget.
Yeah, deficit, trillion.
Right? Trillion, you're right. Well, thank you, absolutely, yeah.
What's interesting, and this goes for whichever party is in power, the party out of power generally talks about deficits, and the parties in power talk about fiscal spending.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see that change, and that just comes with the political landscape, period.
Yeah.
So they're going to do some sort of spending and some sort of tax cuts. But with that said, there are some huge deficit hawks that sit in the House of Representatives on the GOP side. So I don't think this thing is done yet in terms of how that landscape plays out. So primarily, Trump is going to be dealing with the Republican House more so than any Democrats. And we'll see how that shakes.
Okay, also here, oil prices now surging to an 18-month high on the first joint OPEC output report since 2001. This is going to mean people more out-of-pocket spending on gasoline, Lucas, and nobody likes that.
Yep, you're exactly right. So, the OPEC agreed to, cut output at a fairly modest level, but I think, for the first time in a long time, and really signaling the end to this pump everything that we can, flood the market with oil policy that Saudi Arabia has really been promoting for the last several years. And so I think you've seen oil prices bump back up in that $53 to $55 a barrel range. But I think if this continues and OPEC, the members don't cheat on the agreement, which is still right. A very real possibility, I think you will see oil kind of stabilize here. And that is going to drive up the cost mildly of gas and heating oil, especially in the Northeast.
How much money might you see, if gas prices go up like the $3 a gallon? What's the impact on that, Lucas?
I think for the average family, somebody that's driving a car 12,000 miles a year, that can cost an average family another $400 a year per family car. So it does hit people in the pocketbooks if you get higher gas prices, no question.
Yeah, okay. Okay, let's move on to our main topic here today, this notion of how should investors adjust their portfolios given these historic highs in stocks and bonds. And are you sensing a lot of uncertainty among the people you're talking to, your clients, David? The market's way up. Is it going to drop? Are people, no one's ever happy. It's going up and people still are nervous. So what are you sensing out there and the people you're talking to?
Yeah, that's a lot of tribulation as far as what is going to happen. I mean, does this rally continue or is it our artificial rally? Because ultimately the stock market is really going to trend based on corporate profits and how consumers spend and how does that, lead into, falls to the bottom line. So right now we have kind of an exuberance. We don't know if that's going to continue or not. And then we've gone for a fairly significant time with a bull run. So, are we poised for a decline now, a bear market? So people are really concerned. And
The Star had an interesting story yesterday, Alex, this notion that when the Dow hits one of these significant number benchmarks, 1,000, 10,000, 20,000, that's oftentimes followed by the market pulling back for an extended period. I'm not sure how much of that is psychological or coincidental, but it seems to happen. And are you hearing that from your customers?
The 20,000 mark now is kind of the new benchmark for the ceiling. And I think that is true because, remember, on the short term, markets are emotional. So the 20,000 could be an area that's tough to get through. But, I think one of the conversations we can have here in this room with these experienced investors is, are we in a secular bull market?
Meaning?
That means a long-term trend. So you can have a secular bull with an occasional cyclical bear.
Mm-hmm.
So we just came through, for example, from 2000 to 2012 or so, we thought we were having a new bull market back in 2002. It lasted 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that really that was a secular bear, bull inside of a secular bear market.
And if you're listening at home, you can get our podcast and re-listen to that phrase a few times to track all that. I think I got what you're saying.
So if we're in a secular bull now, they can run from 10 to almost 20 years. And certainly we all remember the great one, which was from 82 to 99.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's in its eighth year. So really the debate, I think, for most investors, are we in a secular bull? And that means we'll have some pullbacks, but the long-term trend is still up. That's the debate.
And the bull market in stocks, just to ratify your point here, began in March of 2009. It's up 235% since then. But that's also based on the notion that was the low point coming out of that recession, that almost near economic crash we had right when Barack Obama took office, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That was the very bottom of some very bad times, as most of us would recall. And I think the question that comes on this kind of these long-term bull markets, you know, we came through a long-term bear market, which is what Alex was talking about from, you know, starting in 2000 when the tech bubble burst all the way through to 2012, let's say. So that was a period of time where if you're a stock investor, it was very much below average stock returns. Mm-hmm. Now, what you typically get is you get those kind of sideways periods followed by another strong shot up in growth, shot up in stock price appreciation. So, you know, we've seen a nice little run here, but by historical standards, this could go on for a while longer. So just the fact that we're hitting highs on the S&P 500 or the Dow doesn't mean that it has to come down from here. I think what it has to get supported by to see further stock price appreciation is corporate earnings. You need to see economic growth and better corporate earnings. That's ultimately what drives stock prices over the long term.
Here's some numbers here from 1942 to 65. That secular bull market, to use Alex Petrovic's term, lasted 24 years. The 1982 to 1999 bull market lasted 18 years. And again, you're saying that this current bull market we're in our eighth year. So potentially, at least based on historic standards and historic trends, we could be running a lot longer here.
Yep, that's true. And it's important to remember, though, you will see pullbacks during those periods. But if you're looking at that longer term trend, it's an upward trend of growth.
What's happened to the bond market, David, during these years?
Well, so the bond markets has reacted pretty favorably to low interest rates, this low interest rate environment. So
it's been going pretty strong.
Right. But that is poised to end because as interest rates, the inverse relationship between the price of bonds and the direction of interest rates. And interest rates, as they start flowing upwards, which they have to go up because they've been close to zero for so long, as they go up, the price of bonds is going to be affected negatively. So It creates an interesting situation for the average consumer out there who says, well, maybe I want my money in bonds instead of stocks because stocks are so risky. Well, now the riskiness may have switched over to the bond side. And then so what do you do about that?
How close did we come to a situation where it was going to cost investors money to put money in a bank and the interest rate would be below zero, actually negative? That would have been just an extraordinary thing.
It would have been. And luckily, the American economy has done better than the global economy. So we've seen that in some of the Europe.
Is that right? We did see it.
Yeah. We had negative rates in Japan. I think they're finally positive. We saw them, I believe, in Germany, a couple other of the countries there where they actually, you would give them money and they would give you less in return.
Yeah.
And that was the incentive by those banks. To get people to spend money.
Right.
Don't park it, spend it.
Yeah.
I think it's important to note, though, on an inflation-adjusted basis, we have that in the U.S. today, right? So if you're getting paid 0.01% on your cash money market and inflation is running at 2%, 1 to 2%, which is where we've been, you're losing money in real terms after adjusting for
inflation. Remarkable. Let's do this, gentlemen. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our smart money experts. We'll try to dispense a little more advice about what investors should be thinking about right now. We'll take your questions and calls, too. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yeah, here we go. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, Mayor Sly James discussed a huge infrastructure proposition for Kansas City and the city's increased homicide rate. You can listen to that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we master the Midwestern accent and find out if such a thing even exists. Also, consumer advocate and one-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader shares an important message in an unlikely way. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, our smart money experts, the team is in the house. Lucas Butchel, Alex Petrovic, David Jackson, all talking about recent trends in the economy. We were talking about the bull market before our break and how sometimes these things last even longer than the current one that we've been enjoying. What could end the bull market in stocks, David? As you look out there, what kinds of factors could combine to slow this thing down?
Well, the first one most people are thinking about is just the effects of inflation. If the economy starts heating up a little bit too much, the Fed will feel it necessary to raise interest rates even faster than what they've predicted, and that tends to slow down the economy. That could grind things to a halt. So that's one of the things that they're the fear of things overheating too much, too quick.
Lucas, what else?
You know, I think one of the things is, global trade contraction. So, you know, there's been a lot talked about with the Trump administration, you know, potential trade wars with some of our big trading partners like China or Mexico. I think that really could drive a kind of a bad cycle that, you know, if we got some really negative policy there, could contract trade, drive up inflation in the U.S., and ultimately end this nice run.
Alex, any other factors we should be looking at there?
Well, let's take the option that things continue better. Earnings come around, the market trades higher, and we're trading somewhere 18 to 19 times earnings for the S&P. Let's say we go back to 99 and we trade at 30 times. And most of us these days go, wow, if we ever have another 30 times earnings, I'm getting out. And I would, you know. So maybe just because it does so well, it gets so high, the evaluations are so high, that investors will react negatively to that and get out.
Now, there was a period of time late in Bill Clinton's administration when the market was jumping. It was leapfrogging every day. You almost couldn't believe it. I remember watching it myself and thinking, this is nuts.
Yeah.
You can't last.
We all knew it was nuts. We were just hoping that it would, you know, trend back to normal slowly and not do it overnight. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we don't control that. And in some cases, we know that it, in 02 and then in 08, it did it overnight.
Yeah, it seems like whenever we go through one of those phases, there's that little thought out there, maybe this time it's different. Maybe this time it's different, and it's going to keep going. But,
but it's not different.
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine that says that phrase has lost people more money.
Yeah,
this time is different than anything else.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey,
so I was talking to David in the first half about whether his customers are nervous about what they're seeing out there. Are you sensing the same thing in your customers, Lucas?
I am. I mean, I think people are getting nervous about stock prices just because you see on the news, you know, we're hitting these highs and you know, inevitably that feels like, you know, a high means there's more space to fall. But one of the things that's interesting is I've had a couple of calls regarding the bond returns. So getting negative returns on bonds over the last month as interest rates have kind of spiked up, which is, again, can happen. And I think it's always important to recognize, why do you own these different assets, right? So generally speaking, you've got a strategy that involves a diverse mix of all of those assets. And while bonds may have lost money in 1 month, it's important to know why you own them. They provide that ballast and that stability against big stock market declines. And so it's important to remember your strategy, clearly be aware and manage your investments, but understand why you bought them, not just for the last month, but for the long term.
How many people have come to you guys and said, you know, the bull's going on, the bull market's going on too long, stocks are too hot, I want to put it all in cash? Anybody come to you like that, Alex?
We had a couple of clients before the election get nervous, and actually had two people go to cash right after Trump won, which at this point in time was a bad mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to go back to which investor you're talking to is us advisors, because you could have an older person, which right now knows that they're going to have a cash outlay, perfect time to build cash.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why not?
Pull out if you're older, pull out. And,
especially if you have anything with, you know, right now to 18 months of cash needs that you know is coming up. Boy, get out now. It's a perfect time. Younger people, I mean, who knows? I mean, we could really be in another 10 years of a bull market with correction. So it really depends on what one's objectives are. But we have had people, you know, that are a little nervous right now.
That's so true about what you guys do, because blanket advice never seems to work, because everybody's situation is different, younger people versus older people, and their objectives are night and day different, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, people tend to make decisions based on emotions. So I had a couple of calls like Alex did of people saying, well, it looks like Trump may get in. I want to go to cash, and then the market took off, you know, and they've kind of so far lost. But, you know, you don't want to make your decisions based on emotions. You want to make your decisions based on your personal circumstance. You know, so if you're a little bit older, you don't have the time to deal with volatility. If you're younger, you do. So, you know, you can stand to take the risk.
You know, I got into the market with my 401k, and that's really all I do. I don't want anyone out there to think I'm some wily investor, because I ain't. But having said that, I got in, you know, to the market and investing back in the 80s. And the advice always was, you're in there for the long term. You're not pulling it out. You're not, you know, you just stay the course, which I've done. Does that advice still apply today? Or are there times when you look at this, you know, look at the lay of the land and think, nah, we're backing off here?
You know, I really believe that is was good advice, and that still is good advice. I think that
stay the course, steady Eddie,
build your strategy and then stick to it, especially during times of transition or volatility, because that's the time where emotion can most often trip you up and make you make a bad decision.
Mm-hmm.
Building a strategy and staying the course. Now, it is important to revisit that strategy every once in a while based on life changes. So, you know, a case where we had somebody that was 15 years from retirement, you know, that can afford to be more aggressive. Somebody that's 3 years from retirement, it's probably time to start thinking about, okay, what's my cash plan for that 1 to 5 year period? And, you know, maybe trimming off of stocks now while they're up and building out some cash makes sense. But if you don't need the money, especially in the next 3 years, but even 5 years if you're nearing retirement, I don't see any reason to get real aggressive and change your overall strategy towards investing.
Yeah. Alex, you buy that?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, again, it comes back to the individual investor. So, we have people that say, well, I'm at retirement age. I need to get out of the market. And I said, well, you know, life expectancy, if you're married, one of you is going to live till 90. What's your highest cost going forward? It is medical costs going through the ceiling. So you still need growth at retirement. Once you get into your late 70s, let's say, you know, and you're healthy, then obviously you're not going to be 100% in the market. Nobody with us is 100% in the market, number one. Nobody comes in and say, put all my money in the market.
But even late 60s and 70s, you're saying some of your money needs to be in the market.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that's just where can you ownership is where you make money, not in loanership. So a little advertisement for Commerce Bank. Would I rather own Commerce Bank stock, or would I rather own Commerce Bank's CDs over the past 20, 30, 40 years?
The bank itself, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I want to own it.
Yeah.
I want to loan it.
Yeah. Any disagreement with all this, David?
Not at all. And I think to your point about, you know, what does the average person do? If a person's trying to make a decision based on what's going on now, they got to be right twice. So they got to figure out when to get out to avoid the next crash. And then they also got to figure out when to get back in. And, you know, so if you're basing your feelings on emotion, you're getting out at the bottom because you've suffered this pain. And then you get back in at the top after things have already recovered, and you've lost twice.
Yeah.
So what Lucas says, just staying with it, you know, it's going to help you avoid making those two mistakes.
The Smart Money Experts are in the house. If you want to join our conversation with a question maybe about your situation, 816-235-2888 is the number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So this notion of market timing, again, Dave, you're saying uh-uh.
It's so hard to do it. I mean, there's sophisticated people using computers and all who may, you know, may be successful at it. The average person's not going to be.
Yeah. How about the types of bonds? We talked about bonds not doing very well. If you're going to own bonds right now, what types should people be looking at?
You know, I think that's a great question. So one thing that you want to avoid if you're expecting a rising interest rate environment is long-term bonds. So that's an area that they're most impacted by increases in interest rates. So if you think rates are moving up, you probably ought to revisit your portfolio and trim back on those long-term bonds. Another one that is popular is kind of inflation-protected bonds. So these are bonds that have...
There's such a thing called inflation-protected bonds?
Yep, they're actually issued by the Treasury. They're called TIPS, or Treasury Inflation-Protected Bonds, or securities.
Securities, yeah.
And so they have a component of it that's variable based on an inflation measure. And so if you're concerned about inflation, you can buy bonds that actually have some protection there. I would still look to the shorter end, so the maturities that are on the, you know, say 1 to 8 or 9 years, and not look at those long-term you can buy treasury inflation protected securities that have long maturities. Again, those long maturities are most sensitive to rises in rates.
Yeah. Alex?
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, I agree totally with what David and Lucas have just said. Overall, most people have a combination of stocks and bonds that we deal with. And most people are somewhere in that 60% stocks to 40% bonds. So going forward, we're not going to – I think we're in a lower return environment, even if we have a good stock market, because the bond market is not going to be so great. Mm-hmm. So I think at this point, people are saying that you might expect to make 2% total return on your bond or bond funds over the next 1 to 5 years. So if you're making 2%, because that's currently what the aggregate yield is, if you're making 2% and your stocks do 10 and you're 60-40, you're still back to that, 6% something area. So I think we have to accept we're in a lower return market. At least I've accepted that premise, that we're in a lower return, total return market for our investors for the foreseeable future.
Well, and the question for investors is, do you want to up your stock investment?
Period. Yeah, good question.
Which means you're increasing your risk,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And what would you say to people who are, 30s, 40s, 50s? Is it time to increase your stock portfolio or not?
If they're that age, I agree with it to do that, especially in their 401ks, where they're buying every other week or so, because you're buying the market as it goes up and down. Vanguard did a good research that I just ran into last week that was talking about, if you had a big lump sum now, is it better to dribble it in over 12 months or put it in 100% now? And their testing said almost 70% of the time it makes more sense to put it all in, because you can't time the market, as opposed to dribble it in. And the longer you take to dribble it in, which in our business we call dollar cost averaging, the longer you take, let's say it's a 12-month or 18-month or 24, the higher the percentage goes that you should have just put it in.
Mm-hmm.
In a typical 60-40 portfolio.
Yeah. Makes sense?
Yeah, I think so. The one caveat, again, is what's your risk tolerance, right? So you could go load up on stocks, and then, again, when the stock market falls, because, inevitably it will, if that causes you to freak out and abandon your strategy, that's a bad decision.
Yeah.
And so as long as you have the stomach for the additional volatility that you are absolutely injecting into your portfolio, I'm fine with it, because I agree with Alex. I think you've got a lower expectation for bond returns and a higher expectation for stock returns. However, if you can't handle the bumpier ride, stick with your strategy, rebalance periodically, and stay comfortable with the investment strategy.
How about the ownership of foreign stocks these days? That always comes up. Is that a good investment right now or not?
Well, so foreign investments have probably trended behind the S&P over the last few years.
Hmm.
But then there's always that return to normalcy, or reversion to the mean. So if foreign has underperformed for a while, there's probably going to be a period of time going forward where foreign investments will outperform. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be this year, next year, or when, but eventually it will happen. So I still think foreign investments make sense as part of a person's portfolio, because eventually that's going to be the top performing category. And it's because it's so hard to time the market. You don't want to just try to figure out when is the time to jump in.
816-235-2888 is the number here. Let's go to some phone calls here. Sandra from Excelsior Springs. Sandra, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead, Sandra.
My question is, I'm 65. I will be inheriting an amount of money, and I wanted to know if you'd recommend a certified financial planner to help me decide what to do with it for to be safe and to be smart with the inheritance.
Wow, yeah.
Well, that's sort of a layup for us here, because we're all certified financial planners. So I would pretty much say that's 3-0 on agreeing with that. Yeah.
And what? How would you sit down with Sandra? How would you go about the process of trying to help her sort out what to do with a significant amount of money?
Well,
besides
we'd look
thinking,
at it,
the Steve Kraske two sons scholarship education fund, which is in desperate need of some help, Sandra. But that's a different topic. Yeah.
Well, we'd go to the basics of financial planning, looking at her risks covered, her insurance, so forth, and her estate planning, her wills and trusts if needed, and then we'd look at what she currently owns, what is her appetite or tolerance for risk. So we'd look at it holistically and then make recommendations after we gather that info from her.
Yeah. Sandra, does that make sense?
Yes, it does, but how do I get a hold of these people that would work with me?
How does she figure out who to go to? That's maybe what she's asking there. Yeah.
First off, you can go to the CFP Planner Search. Isn't that Planner Search? What is that?
Yep. So the CFP board has a planner search, so you can go search for CFPs. Also,
that's certified financial planner, Sandra.
Yep. Yeah. And also the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City has a website that you can go to and find search for planners in this area, many of which are going to be CFPs, and find somebody that you want to work with here. So there's a couple of different website tools that will lead you to a nice menu of folks that will give you some good advice.
I think it's CFP.net. Sandra, if that helps, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, good luck, Sandra. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Bye-bye. Let's go to Bill from Grandview. Bill, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just got in on the show, and thank you. This is very interesting. My question is, since the interest rates are creeping up a little bit, where do you think high-yield corporate bonds should fit into your fund as far as just garnering a yield for maybe income purposes?
High-yield corporate bonds, and these are bonds that pay spin-off dividends. Is that what we're talking
about
here?
Their credit rating is lower, so they're forced to pay higher interest rates to get people to buy them.
Okay.
And in a bull market, high-yield bonds are a good place because they both increase in price and their yield's attractive. If he's risk-averse, high-yield bonds as a group lost, 25% in 2008, so they tend to act a lot like stocks.
Right.
So if it's only income you're after and you're willing to stomach the downturns, you know, high-yield bonds have a place in a portfolio, but they're not without risk because they're lower
credit. Are they comparable to REITs at this point?
I would say somewhat because they're very interest rate sensitive, but not exactly. REITs are more sensitive to rising interest rates. High yields, if this bull market lasts, you could make money in the high-yield market where other high-grade yielding instruments like REITs or treasuries will lose money slightly.
All right. Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas to you all.
Bill, same to you. Appreciate the phone call. A listener emailed us to ask this. How about the advantages of buying S&P index funds versus individual stock funds is how I take the question here. Index funds. Explain what an index fund is, David.
Well, so an index fund is just going to track whatever the index is. So the most common index is the S&P 500, which is 500 large companies. And so an index fund just buys those 500 companies, and as those 500 companies perform, you're getting that return. So that's a pretty inexpensive way to invest and know that your money is just going to track with the stock market.
So the index fund, they're buying stocks in proportion to the entire S&P 500 here,
as
somehow.
Opposed to having a manager trying to pick and choose which companies he thinks are going to do well within that index, it's just going to buy that group of companies in proper proportion, and as they do, it's how you'll perform.
So you're taking the guesswork, in a sense, out of the process. You're just buying the index.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, how popular are those index funds, Alex?
They're hugely popular in this environment we're in. They're becoming more popular all the time.
Because?
Well, first off, you know you're never going to underperform the index. You're mm-hmm. not going to overperform. But a lot of active managers, and I think that's what she's referring to, where you buy a fund that you have an active guy that's trying to buy and sell stocks, and they're very cheap. They're like, you know, some of these index funds for the S&P are 7 basis points, which means 100 basis points is 1%. Mm-hmm. 7 basis points. And active managers are typically at the 1% level or more. So immediately you can, they're very cheap and they're very, very attractive for a lot of investors, including us as advisors recommending them to clients these days.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The downside of them is, though, that if the market's going down, you're going down exactly with the market. So, you know, your manager's not making any adjustments to try to save you anything. So you're going to go down as far as market, too. So it's always a trade-off.
Well, Lucas, what do the historical trends show for investors who go with index funds versus those who have a manager pick and choose among different stocks? Over time, has one consistently outperformed the other or not really?
If you're looking at averages, you know, so not comparing one active manager to the index, but if you're looking at the kind of the average of all indexes and then averages of all averages of all active managers, what you've seen is the index funds have been outperforming when you look at the averages across all of the active managers. So if you have a process to be able to select, you know, the best active managers, you can make the case that you might be able to outperform. However, if you're an investor that's looking for broad diversification at a low cost and you don't want to have to spend a lot of time researching managers and tracking them and monitoring their performance, an index fund is oftentimes a great way to go.
Okay. Let me go to Susan from Kansas City, Missouri. Susan, you're on Up to Date with our Smart Money team. Good morning.
Good morning. I have heard that a married couple should have a trust so that if one becomes seriously ill, that illness, the cost of that illness would not cause the other one to become broke.
Hmm.
Should the ill person die?
How about the value of a trust to stave off financial ruin should one spouse become catastrophically ill? Any thoughts?
Well, the trust does provide a plan if something happens to an incapacitated person,
mm-hmm.
where that benefits from the trust. So it does provide a plan as opposed to, you know, if it would go into conservatorship with the court or maybe a child that is less qualified. But I'm not exactly sure that was a question, but that's my best to respond to how I heard the question.
Susan?
Yeah, that's the question. I have heard that it should be routine for any couple to have a trust, any married couple to have a trust. And I just wondered if that was, in his opinion, true.
I would say that it makes sense for every couple to have a living will. And so those kind of documents, maybe not a trust. I think, you know, trust is more for the more affluent in a lot of cases, unless you have small children that you're trying to make sure something happens to both of us. I want to make sure that the small child is taken care of.
But is that a way, her point is that a way to stave off financial ruin if one spouse develops this terrible illness? Does that make...
I'm not sure. A bankruptcy attorney is probably the best person to answer that question. My gut tells me no, though, that you know, there's not some ironclad asset protection tool with a revocable trust, which is what she's talking about. If you're talking an irrevocable trust, that would probably provide more asset protection. However, there's drawbacks to that because once you put that money in there, you know, there's going to be restrictions on what you can take it out and use it for, who has control of it. So, you know, that's really a good question for an attorney, especially somebody that has bankruptcy experience and knows what kind of assets are available to creditors, which ones aren't.
Okay. Susan,
Thank
I hope
you.
That helps.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to wrap things up here. I want to thank our smart money experts one more time for coming in to visit and offering up some good expertise here. Lucas Butchell, a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Alex Petrovic, he's founder of Petrovic Financial Services. David Jackson is with the Financial Planning Association. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Happy holidays to all of you.
Merry Christmas to you, too.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, we reopen the great debate on accents as we learn how to speak Midwestern. Also, who would imagine Ralph Nader writing a fable? Well, he has, but it comes with a very important message. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer, that's Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.